Hello, welcome to the Behind the Headlines podcast with me, Hannah Storm.
And me, John Crowley. In our podcasts, we speak with colleagues from across our journalism industry about the stories they've covered and their own stories as well. We hear from them about how our industry is adapting to the realisation that it needs to take discussions around mental health more seriously and how journalism can shape and normalise conversations around wellbeing.
John and I are both directors of Headlines Network and have been involved in journalism for many years. And we know that journalists aren't robots. They face pressures either because of the stories they cover or the situations they find themselves in wherever they work.
For this episode, we're speaking with Mark Little, the Irish journalist, television presenter and author. Hi, Mark. Thanks for joining us.
John and Hannah, it's been great to be with you.
Mark, you've previously said you were always going to become either a journalist or a politician, but you decided against the latter because you're obsessed with change and not sufficiently ideological. What specifically made you choose journalism, Mark?
Well, before the politician part, I wanted to be a footballer. I wanted to be centre forward for Liverpool, and I had no natural physical talent. So that was going to end up with journalism. The other thing, when I was about 14, I had a religion teacher that wrote in my report card that I was prematurely cynical. And I think it was one of these kids that was precocious. I was always asking the why, curious about everything that I was given as conventional wisdom. So, you know, that led me to the only career that's, you know, you can flourish with that kind of precociousness, and that's journalism. But I was also a little bit obsessed with foreign correspondency. I remember watching like John Simpson, would have been the mid-70s, reporting from wherever he was, and thinking, oh my God, that is the best job in the world. You get to get paid to be in interesting places and get the bejesus scared out of you and then still come home at the end of it all. So that's the way my frame of mind, my mindset before I got into journalism was created, was to think about journalism as always being on the edge of the future, you know, being able to look around a corner and then tell everybody what you just seen, and hopefully at the same time, you know, be in exciting places and potentially get fired at, and, you know, all the things that as young kids you just think war correspondency, it's amazing. And that's how I started out.
I remember having that kind of similar experience with Kate Adey and John Simpson myself, seeing them and thinking, I want to be there. When I grow up, I want to be there. And these iconic moments in the, you know, 80s, where I was like, wow, you know, I really want to do that. And if somebody's going to pay me to do it, all the better, right? But so talk us through the beginnings of your career. You were at RTE, right?
Yeah, so I started out just the tail end of what we call the Troubles. That was, you know, what was going on in Northern Ireland. So I would have joined RTE, you know, early 90s. One of my first major jobs was to go there and report on the last sort of 6 months of the conflict before the IRA ceasefire. So it was a particularly gruesome summer, I remember, and standing on top of the tallest building in Belfast, where RTE had their offices, and just watching to see where the sirens were heading next, and then giving a call to the RUC press office back then and saying, what's happened? And, you know, turning up minutes after people had been shot dead by loyalist militants. And at the same time, then trying to describe a conflict that had been going on for decades in a way that wasn't cliche. And I remember interviewing people who'd been bereaved and widowed, and they would say the same thing. They would say, you know, he was killed simply because he was a Catholic. And you could hear the same thing said over and over again. So how do you describe this awful, horrific conflict every day in a way that can still make people interested and care? And that was my first experience. And I think that for me as a storyteller was a tremendous education. Sorry to be crass about it, but I learned a lot about how to convey suffering to people sitting in their front room back home who, you know, have a choice between watching you on the news and watching, you know, the football on the other channel. And that was something that really gripped me. So from there, I was lucky enough then to be sent to Washington as the first RTE Washington correspondent. So I set the bureau up for the Irish public TV station. I was 26. I was so young that my boss at the time advised me to either grow a mustache or get glasses. Or he said, if you wear blue, it makes you look older. Like, I looked like Donny Osmond. I was so young. So I, you know, lived my dream way too early. I was 26 at this stage, and I had got basically the plum job in Irish journalism. So I had only one way to go, which was downhill.
And talk to us a little bit about, you know, where you went from there. I mean, I know that we've been friends for quite a while now, and we've spoken in the past about some of the conflicts you've covered, the environmental disasters you've covered. You've previously said that for many years you despite what you've just described there, you considered yourself as immortal and until you had a serious skiing accident. Tell us a little bit more about the impact that had on you, your mental health, and then your career as well.
When I look back, I mean, I was a product, and I think, you know, all three of us were really of the gung-ho school of journalism. Like, I remember getting briefly kidnapped in Colombia for a couple of hours and thinking it was really exciting to go back to the pub, you know, and I go back to Washington and tell people about this and, you know, flying in Seahawk helicopters, you know, over war zones. And then I got back to Ireland after my stint in Washington, and this happened after 9/11. So Iraq, Afghanistan, I remember in Lebanon once, you know, taking a trip to the southern city of Tyre and walking into a convenience store and working out that there was probably a fraction I could work out of my brain that I was going to be killed that day. And the knowledge that I kind of had some control over that and that I would survive at the end of the day just made it all the more addictive. And so back then, I thought, first of all, failure is not an option, right? Number two is, if there's a plane in front of you, jump on it and get going somewhere. And then the other thing was survival. Survival was the crucial thing. Get out at the end. And it doesn't matter what trauma you might go through, but if you can pat down your body at the end of the day and you still have your limbs intact and you're not completely traumatized, then that's a victory. And you just get up the next day and do it again. So that gung-ho sense for me kept going through what I would describe as, you know, very traumatic circumstances in Iraq in 2003, where I witnessed friends killed. I was in the tsunami, the aftermath of the tsunami, the Boxing Day tsunami of 2004, where literally reporting from a sea of bodies, telling people at home that words cannot describe what I'm seeing. Now, words could describe, but I just didn't want to, because the horror of what I was seeing around me just could not be communicated without me breaking down. So I kind of covered all that up and I sort of suppressed a lot of that stuff. And then I was about to go to Iraq for what would have been my most dangerous assignment. I was embedded in a combat outpost in a place called Ramadi. It was 2007. I was warned not to go by some senior security advisors, but I was going. And I took a quick break with my friends and my wife, and we went to ski in northern Italy. And on the last day, when everybody was hungover and didn't want to go, I pushed myself, type A personality I was. And the last run of the day, I had a severe injury. I was broke my knee and I was on the side of this mountain, and it was the last run of the day. Nobody was coming. It was a snowstorm. And I thought, oh shit, death and mortality is not where I expected it to be. You know, I was going to Ramadi expecting to go through some sort of risk. And it was that reminder of my mortality. And I just began a process after that incident and that accident and the recovery of it, of going through a combination of deep anxiety, which ended up becoming depression, which I know I had to deal with. And also then a real sense of reordering my priorities in life and realizing that, you know what, failure is not only an option, but it's probability. Survival is not the important thing, it's resilience. And all of these things crowded together in what I talked about at the time, I think to friends of mine, as a midlife crisis, but it was much deeper than that. It was 39 years old, what am I doing with my life? What am I doing in terms of my addiction to this kind of gung-ho lifestyle? So yeah, it was a whole, like a house of cards collapsing because of that moment I lay on the side of that hill thinking to myself, my God, my mortality is so pronounced. I couldn't see it.
It's really interesting you mention that, because in our first episode, we were speaking with Lise Doucette and Lindsay Hilsum, and Lise was talking to us about how journalism is always one more step further, one more interview, one more conversation. And actually, it strikes me then that your skiing experience was that kind of, you know, the last day, the one more ski run, and almost kind of like, you know, it made you gain a sense of perspective around the professional life. That personal experience made you gain that sense of perspective that perhaps you hadn't been able to acquire through the professional journalism to that date.
It's a great point, very perceptive. I mean, Hannah, I think the thing for me was I realized that this war correspondency and journalism in general for me was an addiction. You know, and I remember being in war zones with friends of mine that are still today. I see them in Ukraine. And I know that they're addicted. Now, they have found many ways to cope, and people like Lise Doucette. And I think a lot of the new generation of war correspondents are way more emotionally intelligent. And they have developed, I think, a whole set of resilience tactics that weren't there when I was in the field. you know, I remember being with Mary Colvin in Palestine at one stage in the West Bank, and I remember she talked about the addiction that she felt and has been chronicled. And I think at the time I was both kind of horrified but also very impressed. And it was, as you rightly point out, sitting there and for the weeks afterwards in hospital as I recovered from what was a serious operation, I remember thinking to myself, I am an addict. And this has obviously exposed the level of addiction, because my type A personality put me out there in that ski resort. And actually, if I keep doing this, I will not be able to function as a normal human being unless I'm in the war zone, which is something that I had heard from a lot of correspondents. They felt most normal when they were in the war zone. And when they came home, they couldn't be lived with by their families for days, weeks sometimes. And they were always just waiting for the next chance to get back on that plane and put on the flak jacket and be normal again. And I could see that moment, that was my future if I continued on. It wasn't that I lost the energy for or passion for foreign reporting. It's just I had to confront a lot of the lies that I was telling myself about the survival and getting through the next day and pushing yourself to the next story. It does catch up with you. And to pretend it doesn't is essentially to invite unhappiness, and probably not just for yourself, but anyone who loves you and is close to you.
In our first episode of this Behind the Headlines podcast series, we spoke to Lindsay Hilsum and Lise Doucette about Marie Colvin. It was the 10th anniversary of her death in Syria. And of course, poor Marie was like that. She would keep on chasing that story, going into far more dangerous places than perhaps she should have done. When you were working in these regions, were people speaking about this? Not just about the danger, but the mental toll that this was perhaps taking on you? Or did you just not kind of realise or know? Or was the thrill of the story just all-consuming?
One thing about Maria, I was in the West Bank with her, and I was leaving because the Israelis had come in and shot up the building we were in and raided it, and it was a pretty awful, gruesome moment. And a day after, I left to go back into Jerusalem. And Marie said, I can't leave. I have a commitment to these people. And so with Maria, it wasn't just about gung-ho. And I think this is one thing I would, to be fair to people who still do this job. Many believe deeply that they need to stay or go again because it's a service to the people who otherwise wouldn't have their stories told. So there's this mix. I definitely think the gung-ho addiction, particularly in male correspondents. There's also then that deep-seated feeling that if it's not me, if I can't bear witness to this suffering, no one will see it. And I think that's what inspired Marie. And, you know, again, she probably had the addiction, but also had a deep-seated connection. So the combination of factors, purpose-driven, mission-driven, that sense of, if not me, who's going to tell the story, with the periodical, habitual addiction of it all. And like anything in life, if you do it enough times, it just becomes the habit. It's that combination where you can keep telling yourself it's for a higher purpose, but sometimes it's also because some baser instinct has been captivated. And that combination can be quite toxic after a time, even though it's so high-minded and deeply passionate and mission-driven. So even the best of us, I think, can sometimes go back into the war zone, sometimes for the wrong reason. So that's really one of the things I've noticed, particularly people I know are still doing it right now, is that, you know, they're not just junkies. They're not just people who are addicted to the thrill. There's something else there that is high-minded, but the two together can be really toxic for the individual journalist.
In one of our other podcasts episodes, we spoke with Sian Williams, and she spoke about that notion of bearing witness that you've just mentioned, and this idea that actually, you know, when we have this really strong belief and commitment to the work we're doing, it can be quite a good, she calls it an emotional flak jacket, can be quite a good way of protecting our own mental health as well. I'm just curious to hear your thoughts on that, but also this idea that war reporting, we often associate war reporting as having a mental kind of health impact in terms of things like PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. But are there other kind of mental health tolls that you've seen on people who are covering war as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, you know, I look at PTSD, and I was just watching Fergal Keane's documentary quite recently there about his feeling of it. And I think it's quite clear that many people can go through traumatic situations in war zones and not have that same level of PTSD. For some of us, we go and we see that trauma, but we all carry the vicarious trauma with us. You know, that sense, like, this is the first thing I discovered this was when I set up Storyful, which was essentially, you know, eyewitnesses. We were journalists operating online. Of course, we were never going near a front line, but we were seeing the Arab uprisings were happening at the time, the first beheading videos. So I remember the first time we realized that these journalists who were working on a laptop in Dublin were witnessing more horrific and gruesome imagery than I had ever seen in a war zone. And so the vicarious trauma of being essentially sort of in some ways having a secondhand experience of what you see, not something you suffer yourself in the war zone, but the witnessing of suffering. And so one of the things I remember, there was a fantastic education that we went on with Storyful's curators. One of the things, and Bruce Shapiro from the Dart Center in Colombia was one of the people who talked us through this, a sense of purpose at the end of the day. Why did you see that image? Did you just come across it accidentally? Was it something that you're doing all the time? Is there a purpose? And the sense of mission was so critical. So at the end of the day, when you close the laptop, you knew the reason you saw those images and the reason you had to document them, because if you didn't, they could end up in wider circulation, traumatizing a lot more people who are accidentally seeing the imagery. So that sense of mission and purpose at the end of a day was something I remember Bruce drove home to me. And it wasn't, as I say, until I was in charge of a team of people that I realized I didn't understand that when I was in the war zone. I thought that in some ways this was just an occupational hazard, as opposed to something I had to do because I had a mission and I had purpose. And that's where I think a lot of the people that I admire so much, like Lise Doucette, you know, she's not going into these war zones because she wants to have a higher dose of adrenaline or, you know, suffering. She's doing it for a reason. And I think that's why there's a much more grounded sense about foreign correspondency today that I see and I admire. And it was only, as I say, witnessing suffering through the eyes of my team at Storyful and the people like Bruce Shapiro leading us that I realized that sense of mission is critical.
That's so interesting about a sense of purpose and a mission, Mark. You just mentioned there Storyful. You left RTE to form the company, I think it was in 2009, which was described as the world's first social news agency. And for those listeners wondering what that might mean, it was around user-generated content. And if you think of the way now news organizations use user-generated content all the time, and they certainly didn't do it in 2010, you've moved the dial on the industry, Mark, if you don't mind me saying. I was lucky enough to come across you when Storyful was acquired by News Corp in 2013. I was working at the Wall Street Journal then, and it really changed the way that, yeah, we did digital news. You spoke there about vicarious trauma and the risk that people are exposed to. I guess it was, you know, it was a different time then. There was a kind of lots of idealism then around social media and the power of what it could do. Do you have a message for the idealistic Mark Little then? And do you slightly miss that more innocent social media world that we worked in then?
Yeah, I mean, it was, I think, the stages of the internet. And I think of this, the first wave of liberation, you know, which was the Arab uprising. And I still think about it in terms of Me Too and Black Lives Matter. I still see that internet that I became absolutely fixated by, because my jumping moment from traditional journalism into Storyful, as it was the Iran protest in 2009, where, you know, I wasn't sent by my news organization, even though Iran was my story. And I remember watching Twitter, and I could see the bodies being dragged off Valley Asr Square in northern Tehran, just as I think it was John Simpson was in a hotel room saying reports coming in of shots fired in Valley Asr Square. But I was seeing it in Dublin on Twitter. And it was that holy shit moment again when I said, oh my God, well, now we have the ability to allow ordinary people who are the eyewitnesses to be the storytellers. They don't need me as a gatekeeper. And I think that sense of mission and of possibility was what led me to jump out of my big, high-paid, glamorous job as a TV anchor. And in retrospect, to be quite honest, there was actually a lot of ego in it as well. Like, you know, it's that great moment, you know, there's a chapter from the Talmud that talks about, if not me, who, and if not now, when. You know, there's a tremendous amount of ego it takes to jump out and start a news organization from scratch. But luckily, I managed to recruit some of the most visionary and pioneering social journalists. People like Malachy Brown is now the head of the Visual Investigations Unit at the New York Times. A lot of those people who are, you know, came out of the visual investigations tradition that we kind of created along with people like Bellingcat. So in many ways, the thing I look back on in Storyful is not that I created that company, but I built the team that built a new form of journalism. And did it at a time in the internet where we were feeling like this was a liberating force. It was democratic. It was ground up. It was giving voices to people that traditional journalists had ignored. And it was, you know, until I think around the sort of 2012 and 13, when we started at Storyful to see the first evidence of manipulation and propaganda from, for example, the Syrian government. Staged videos. We started to see the first chemical weapons attacks in Syria and the Russians trying to essentially flood the zone with misinformation. And I think that turning point where we started to see the enemies of democracy weaponizing the internet and its vulnerabilities and its virality. And I think that's the turning point that now, you know, we look back in retrospect and say we should have seen it coming. The platforms should have seen it coming. But it is definitely... has been a change. So went from liberation to weaponization. And I think we're still in that phase of the development of the internet.
And that marked a turning point for you, didn't it, Mark, as well, when you were, as I said, you were acquired by Rupert Murdoch's News Corp in 2013. And you were kind of like this plucky little startup that was, you know, suddenly you were selected by News Corp to be in the vanguard of its journalism, which in itself was controversial, I imagine, with your staff. You said one thing at the time, that being acquired by News Corp allowed you to say no to things that you didn't want to do. Can you say what that was?
Yeah, I mean, it's for me, looking back, it's obviously mixed messages from Storyful. It's a success because it produced people who've redefined a certain type of journalism. But it was a failure in the sense we didn't manage to get free of the centrifugal force of venture capitalists and that horror of would we keep the lights on. I remember one moment during due diligence for the sale of Storyful, we got this questionnaire from News Corp and how many aircraft do you own? And like, we couldn't buy light bulbs, you know, like we were that broke. And, you know, to be quite honest, any news executive out there will know this feeling. Your job, right, as a boss in a news organization is to soak up the anxiety for everybody around you. And not let them know just how difficult the next week could be. You're going to run out of money by the end of the month. Who needs to know that? Nobody but you. And for me, that's what I meant when we were bought by News Corporation. You know, we knew, first of all, that Murdoch himself wanted this. I think it wasn't like the Wall Street Journal where there was an op-ed, or it was literally just that we were doing this new type of journalism. And for us, the liberation was I didn't have to worry about the light bulbs. That was somebody else. It meant that we could devote days to the investigation in Syria and not worry about getting another 5 cute cat videos to pay the rent. So that was the liberation, and working with people like you, John, and working with the newsrooms of the Times in London or the Wall Street Journal, getting deeply embedded then in investigative work, which was a liberation. So actually, ironically, for the team that I led, being part of a bigger news organization was freedom. Now, for me as an executive, it was totally different. I suddenly had to, you know, make money for News Corp, but at least I didn't have to worry about keeping the lights on or paying the rent at the end of the month. And that was quite liberating.
When I was thinking about how I introduced you, I thought about calling you an entrepreneur, but I'm glad I didn't, because I've since read that you think all entrepreneurs are assholes. So you consider yourself a storyteller, I suppose, and you always have. All the time I've known you, a storyteller who innovates. And yet, when we were communicating prior to this podcast, you did call yourself an entrepreneur, which, I mean, I'll leave the listeners of this podcast to make their own sense from that. However, I guess my question for you is, you know, you've talked there about the moment that you sold Storyful, the light bulbs versus aircraft, all of those challenges it brought, and yet some of the kind of liberating elements too. But you've kind of touched on the mental health impact too. And I'm curious to hear, you've talked about mental health aspects of war corresponding, of war reporting, of the vicarious trauma. How different were the mental health tolls that you had to deal with as an entrepreneur slash innovator to the kind of war correspondent?
It's a great question. They're very similar, you know, and I think if you look at every take bro with a fleece jacket and ideas about how they're going to change the world, like, I mean, it's very similar to the gung-ho foreign correspondent, right? Which is like, failure's not an option. You know, we survive even if we ran out of money. And it's so similar. So in some ways, when I left RTE and I had friends of mine, in retrospect, they told me they were going to do an intervention because they thought I was having a nervous breakdown. And in kind of some ways I was, you know, I had gone through the anxiety of that horrible accident when I was skiing. And then 2 years later, I left RTE because just I couldn't sustain it. I had this feeling in my mind, well, I've got this idea. And if I don't do this, I'm going to regret it in 25 years. So I only became an entrepreneur because it was a means to an end. I certainly didn't want to be that. And I don't enjoy the description because entrepreneurs, you know, they're full of themselves. They have to be, because the vast majority of startups don't succeed. And the vast majority of startups that are acquired by another company generally get eaten up and killed. So like ultimately to be an entrepreneur is to know you will fail. And so I have gone on a journey as, let's call it the founder of a business, as a founder. I like that better than entrepreneur. And it has been much more traumatic than I thought it would be. It's definitely, I've had to live with the idea that anxiety is a chronic illness. And I just deal with it that way. I have probably higher than average levels of imposter syndrome because every day I'm being asked to say something about the future. And imagine it exists in my own mind. And every day I've got to get up and soak up the anxiety of my team. Now, the better thing I've done now, and I'm in my second business with Kinzen, I have a co-founder, Anya Kerr, who is just remarkable as somebody who grounds me. And, you know, I'm not on my own anymore. And sharing that burden together has been a secret that I have helped, you know, overcome my anxieties. But yeah, being an entrepreneur is exactly like being that gung-ho foreign correspondent. And again, I come back to this differentiation between survival and resilience. My job is not to keep the lights on in the business. It's to make sure that every day we get up, we know it's going to be tough, but we got this. You know, we got a kick in the head yesterday and likely we'll get a kick in the head today, and that's okay. And it's not going to finish next month or next year. We might have 4 years of this, but it's okay because we've got a mission and a purpose, and we develop a kind of a sort of a second skin. Every day we can overcome that challenge, we get stronger. And that for me is the most liberating thing about being in a startup, but also being in a second startup. And also I think for my own mental health, it's helped me then see anxiety as atmospheric rather than some sort of like ailment or illness. It's just that something that comes with being on that edge. And so therefore you're never going to cure it, but you can get better at being anxious, you know, and you can get better at getting stronger. And so it's like water. I always think the way I describe it is when you jump into that cold water the first day, you're paralyzed with the cold. You jump in the second day and it's less paralyzing. And by the fifth day, it's fine. And that's the way I feel now, is that the anxiety doesn't go away. It just becomes way easier to deal with. And in some ways becomes almost like an empowering thing, is when you feel that tingle of anxiety, you know you're entering new territory, and with that comes excitement. So yeah, I've not saying I've cured it, I have not. I will never cure anxiety, but it becomes easier to deal with.
It really resonates with me. I mean, I for many years felt that, you know, this acute imposter syndrome, but also this sense of kind of shame around talking about my own mental health. But I think being able to use that and turn it the other way, so their vulnerability becomes something like a strength. And, you know, John and I work together in a similar way to the way you've described you and Anya work. You know, it's very empowering and it's a great collaboration, which is fabulous because Headlines Network is still a startup as well. But I'm very struck by that idea of failure and learning from failure. I remember one of my kids at school, their head teacher used to say fail stood for first attempt in learning. And I always remember that because I think it's a really powerful thing to say. So you say you've in the past that you've never learned from your successes, and yet there have been many, but instead from your failures. Can you give us any more examples of that?
Yeah, so I mean, I'm always a big fan of that Samuel Beckett quote, you know, he says, you know, ever tried, ever failed, no matter, try again, fail better. Now, a lot of entrepreneurs will use that. And in fact, I know somebody I met who's got that tattooed on their arm. I talked to a Beckett scholar recently, and they tear their hairs out when they listen to this, because what Beckett was actually saying was not like a question, have you ever failed? He's basically saying, you've failed. You will fail. There's no purpose here. You'll fail again. You'll just happen to fail better. And what he's saying is not like an exhortation to go out there and put yourself at the edge of failure. It's just like, deal with it. this is life. And once you get to the point where you're okay with failure, then it becomes a liberation. So I'll give you an example. I think it was a year into my journey with Storyful, and I had no money left. And I had a couple of angel investors who said, okay, we'll give you a certain amount of money. And that was going to save the business. And there was just something that didn't click between us. And on Christmas Eve, I said no to the money, get into a car with my wife, drove through a snowstorm, and I was halfway to my family's house. And if you remember, Chris Rea, Driving Home for Christmas, was 15 times on the radio. And I couldn't tell my wife that I had turned the money down and the business was going to go under. And I finally said, listen, here's, I've got something to admit to you. And I was liberated because I'd shared this. And what was the worst could happen? I'd just go off and get a job. Now, I got down to my family's house and one of the lead investors said, I'm not taking no for an answer. And he put the money in and the business was back up and running. But I had confronted my worst fear and it was okay. And so therefore, I never, ever was plagued by the worst fear anymore. And again, back to that Beckett notion, like we will fail. That's the nature of life. And if you don't get okay with that, you are never going to flourish. You are never going to have that idea because you'll be gripped by the sense of what might happen if it goes wrong. And that's why, you know, I hate when I see tech bros using that quote to exhort themselves onto, you know, Bitcoin. But I love people saying it as part of the part of life. And so when I see a lot of my friends who have gone through, let's call this a mental health journey, and they talk about it as if they've got over it and they've solved it all. And I'm looking at them going, that's not the way this works. You've obviously, to varying degrees, we all have this and we will live with it probably forever. And that's okay. And as soon as you realize that, then that's where creativity comes from. And that's where you can take the next step. And then you turn it around a bit. And I don't like quoting Jeff Bezos, but he's a great line. He said, what he found at Amazon, he had a regret minimization framework, right? He just needed to know that he wouldn't regret in 25 years that he hadn't done this. And that's why he did it. It wasn't a great dream of success. It was, he was trying to avoid regret. And, you know, out of that kind of sort of ordinary acceptance of failure comes greatness. And that's my experience, at least in my very minimal experience of over the past 15 years.
Mark, you spoke there about your current role as CEO of Kinzen. Can you tell us a little bit more about what you do there?
Yeah, so what we do is provide early warning of misinformation and hate speech to some of the big technology platforms. I mean, obviously, as you know, we've had fact-checking for a very long time, but, you know, we are much more proactive. So we use a team of analysts around the world, with now 17 languages we examine, and also machine learning, which helps us pinpoint the worst examples of misinformation or hate speech. So, for example, looking at India right now, where there's almost like genocidal levels of rhetoric against Muslims. So we're looking for those places where the misinformation is not just about contested views, but it's about real world harm. And over time, that the technology itself has started to really become the accelerant. So we now have access to vast machine learning models that help us analyze speech and directly identify when something is actually going to have an impact in the real world. And so we work with tech platforms, content moderators, and more we're looking more at audio, which is kind of the next frontier, one of the most difficult areas to examine. So anywhere where there's a conversation, we're helping the trust and safety teams protect that conversation from what we obviously saw during COVID, but also during elections and, you know, constantly these atmospheric threats from hateful speech. That's kind of what we do at the moment.
It's so interesting that you talk about that real world harm, because I think that often people struggle to make the connection between the violence that takes place on the internet, online hatred, disinformation, misinformation, and its impact on real life. We've previously spoken with Mariana Spring, the BBC's first specialist disinformation reporter. And recent years, as you well know, have seen disinformation undermining the critical work done by journalists and causing that real damage to people and to democracy. How do we go about fixing the systems that make our online communities toxic, especially, you know, from your perspective, but especially given your previous work at Twitter, for instance?
It's going to be a whole series of measures. I mean, obviously, first and foremost, regulation, and it's coming. Obviously, Digital Services Act here in Europe is going to make the decisions being taken by the platforms more transparent, more accountable. There's going to be a code of practice on disinformation probably by June, which will help establish exactly what needs to happen. There's got to, I think, also got to be for the platforms themselves is to start building safety by design. And what I mean by that is looking at the underlying algorithms, which in most social media platforms are primed for outrage, for emotion, because that's what gets people to buy things and that's what drives advertising. But I think over time as well, we're going to start to see a lot of decentralization of what we currently think is content moderation. So we see it even on Twitter to an extent where you'll see labels popping up to tell you this is a state-sponsored Twitter account, or you'll say, hey, have you read that article before sharing it? And so I think what we're going to start to see is our experience of the internet will resemble a lot more the kind of productivity apps that we have for our sleep and our exercise, where we will start to see an automation of labeling and literacy to help us as digital citizens not be digital subjects. So even the work that we're doing at Kinzen, we're constantly thinking in a couple of years' time, could we have a information labeling system that is pointing people toward the credible information? And at the same time, you know, labeling things that allow the user to take the decision of whether they want it in their feed or not, and, you know, not make it so opaque and centralized as it is right now. So that's the way I think things are going. But it will take many things to happen. And I think one of the things is for journalists to start to, you know, think about their role in the information ecosystem, because the biggest toxic element right now is what they call the liar's dividend. The likes of Vladimir Putin and these disinformers, they don't have to convince you what they're saying is true. They just have to convince you that everybody is lying. And so that's a massive, I think, in many ways, fundamental challenge to the nature of journalism, where we have to, as journalists, realize that we can no longer play that gatekeeper role. Right? Because now, you know, that role as the fourth estate, I think in some ways is so obsolescent. I think we individually as journalists have to think about ourselves as being defined by the engagement we have with the particular audience we're trying to work with our communities. And so I love to think when I hear people talking about solutions journalism and community journalism, I think at its heart what it means is it's not good enough to say you work for the whatever the news organization is. It's important for you to say, I serve this community and this is how I engage with them. And the way I mark my success is my credibility with that community, not my status and not my position, not the job title that I have next to my name.
So I guess it's a little bit back to that sense of purpose, isn't it? And kind of anchoring us in that. And I think that that's probably quite helpful, because I don't know about you, but, you know, to what extent do you feel the pace of news now and the constant social media exposure is posing a mental health challenge to journalists?
Yeah, and I think about Mariana a lot, you know, in the abuse that she suffered for the work she does. And I think anybody, and particularly women in the field of fighting disinformation, misinformation, come in for like exponentially more abuse and more serious abuse. So two things, I think, is speed. Obviously, all of us have that feeling, no matter how knowledgeable we are about a subject, of feeling stupid because it moves so quickly. You know, we can't keep up with what happened in Ukraine or whatever subject we're following. So we all have that sort of Dunning-Kruger syndrome, right? Where the smartest people feel more stupid because all the stupid people sound so authoritative. And that's one of the biggest problems, is leveling of expertise online. Speed obviously is huge. And then I think it is that act of stepping out and putting your neck on the line for something you believe in online exposes you to a level of abuse that I have never seen in the time, the decades I've been a journalist. And so that, I think, is really the undiagnosed mental health crisis that journalism is facing, that there's a generation of journalists that are coming of age in a time where to be knowledgeable on the internet is to expose yourself to attack, and sometimes concerted attack by, you know, very powerful enemies. And so I think that is where the job of a journalist today online is so much more difficult than when it was simply me saying, hey, I'm on the telly, sit down, listen to what I say, you've got no way of answering back. And so I think out of this crisis, as I've described it, is going to come, I hope, a journalism rooted deeply, and much more deeply in community than it was when I was the man on the telly telling people what the truth was. But it's going to take, I think, a lot more trauma and probably a lot more abuse before we finally find a way to have journalism embedded back in the community.
You spoke just there about journalism serving communities, and yet you've also talked in the past personally about not belonging to anywhere, that home is wherever those you love are. Is that still the case? And surely from one Irishman to another, surely the LSOT is always home for you, Mark?
Oh, listen, John, we bond over that in many different ways, I know, rooted in our soul. I think it is like that great line. I remember Tip O'Neill was a former US politician. He said, to be Irish is to know you will suffer. And I think that's one of the things, like being a fairly mordant, pessimist in some ways, gives you the ability just to not be knocked down too much by what's going on online. And I do think also in Ireland, like I lived in the United States for quite a while, coming back home to Ireland at around the time when we passed the marriage equality laws, and Ireland went from being a really, as you know, John, like a really conservative, retrogressive, church-dominated society to being like really driven by solidarity. So I must admit, being rooted back home in Ireland has given me a much more deep sense of commitment to community. And the rootlessness, and I say that in the R-O-O-T sense of it, that I felt possibly as a foreign correspondent, yeah, I look at that as being part of the problem, you know? You can't just be a citizen of the world or a citizen of the internet. You know, you have to live with your 2 feet on some piece of ground in some community. And that ability to have both, you know, I can travel and I can be on the internet talking to people in California as much as I can talk to people in County Kerry. At the same moment in time, that's the great thing about the internet. But in the end of the day, when I get up in the morning, I'm part of a community. And I've that deep sense of both of those things at the moment is what's, I think, keeping me sane. I also do a bit of sea swimming. So I go running down in the morning and have that moment of zen, which gives me about 25% more productivity when I come home. And that's one of the things I picked up from the pandemic.
And I bet that was flipping difficult the first day you got into the water, just like you said, with the anxiety, you know, every day it gets slightly easier, right?
And also you pick up that great, what's that chemical called? Smog,
yeah.
Right? You know, like what's the joke is, how do you know someone goes sea swimming? As they tell you. So you do get that sense of validation that before, you know, 8 o'clock in the morning, you've already put yourself out there. And yeah, it gives a great sense. I mean, it is that, you know, the Wim Hof method, the idea of you expose yourself to trauma every day, your brain is tricked into believing that that trauma is okay and you can survive anything. So there is actually, I think, some brain chemistry at play there in anything like this kind of habit where you put yourself through pain. And I can see you, Hannah, in your Twitter feed, putting yourself through pain every single day and looking better for it all the time.
You're too kind. But I just wanted to pick up on your point about being rooted and grounded and kind of, you know, also previously flying. The last couple of years, and we've heard from you already, some of the stresses and pressures on journalism and the trauma people are experiencing the last couple of years, quite frankly, have been really difficult, you know, very personally for people, professionally for people, and around the world for many, many people. And yet you've just spoken about something so positive about finding a place where you ground yourself and your feet, your body are in one place. I found the same. I've moved somewhere where I'm now part of a community. It's wonderful, but it allows me also to connect with people in my community, but then do the kind of traveling I need to. I was going to ask you how you coped with being forced to stay in one place for so long during the pandemic, but for a man who flew so much and traveled so much and traveled so light, how did you cope with being forced, but also kind of find that new way of thinking about the community?
Yeah, not very well is the answer for the first year. I mean, it was like losing my limbs. You know, I'm used to the idea of learning by talking to people, like, you know, and seeing people and having that body language and watching when someone's bored stiff by something you've just said or when something sparks in a conversation. It's a physical thing. Like I grew up in Ireland, and John knows, like, as a kid, I would sit in pubs watching the adults capturing each other's attention. So that was part of what I learned, was like, you've got about 10 seconds in an Irish pub to grab someone's attention. And I think that's what allowed me to go to, you know, meetings and go into events and have that great contact. So when I lost that, I was bereft for a long time. But then I realized on a call, you know, like Zoom calls, I can get in touch with friends on the other side of the world. And I also started realizing the importance of having mentors. Now, I myself hopefully have provided mentoring to people that I really care about. And there's nothing greater in the world than having someone who wants to be on a phone call with you or a Zoom call, asking for advice and thinking you can have a positive impact for them. Equally then, having my own peers that that I can come to in a WhatsApp group or just on DM sometimes in Twitter, or sometimes if I need to on a Zoom call to say, hey, I'm having a hard day today and there's something I just can't get my head around, or I'm feeling like an imposter, talk me down off this ledge. So I've realized now that actually the pandemic has forced us in some ways to seek out more grounded emotional connections than simply walking in a room and everybody talking at each other. I also realized the unconscious biases that I had, you know, like you gravitate in the room toward the loudest voice sometimes, or, you know, the mansplainer who's using a lot of physical activity to get a point across. And I suddenly realized that sometimes in these Zoom calls, there was a great equalizer, that everyone's voice carried the same weight. So yeah, I've gained a lot of things by being forced to sometimes reach out and ask for help, when in the past I would have just turned up and had a chat over a cup of coffee. But sometimes actually asking for help is the first step in solving a problem. Or when people come to me more and more and they're asking me for help, and I know that if I can help them in some way, I can unlock potential. And as you get older, I think over a certain age, you realize your job in life is to help good people do great things. And that has been something that I've leaned into in the last few months and years. Like, I was at a conference recently, the one, you know, probably the Willy Wonka Chocolate Factory of Journalism Festivals, Perugia. And I found myself walking into rooms, not looking for people I knew, but looking for people I didn't know, and listening to new experiences. And I got so much more fulfillment out of that experience than I did in the past, where, you know, you all gravitate toward the coffee shop or the bar.
We're going to ask your advice around mental health soon, but you were just talking about experience there. We also ask of all our guests to talk about one story that might have impacted them the most, one that you've covered, Mark. Is there one story that kind of stays with you, that you come back to and reflect on at all?
Yeah, there is one story I was covering in the US. I became fascinated in, I suppose, a very dark way with the death penalty. And I went down to Huntsville, Texas, to death row, to the death chamber. And I went in and I interviewed a man called Michael Lockhart, who was a mass killer and had a conversion at the very last minute. So I sat with him and he said, I'd done walked that walk 1,000 times. And I then walked the walk that he would take the following Tuesday to a bed shaped like a crucifix. And I interviewed him and I went back to Washington. And at Tuesday at 5 o'clock, I stood outside. I was a smoker then, having a cigarette, knowing the moment of death of a man that I had just met. And to this day, I can never forget that sense that no person should know the time of another person's death like that. I mean, it was, death row for me was this industrial process. I think that was when George W. Bush was governor and there was the record level of executions. And that has stuck with me ever since. And yeah, there was no trauma involved to me. There was a very organized process by which we got the interview with this man, Michael Lockhart. And it was a very industrial process by which they put him to death. But nothing in that experience ever felt normal or natural. And it's one of those things, whenever I think about all the exciting times I've flown in Black Hawk helicopters down the Tigris River. But that one, yeah, that touched me in a way that deeply unsettled me even today as I speak about it.
Gosh, and I can feel that. I can hear that in your voice, but also, you know, me myself, I kind of was feeling my hands starting to kind of get a bit sweaty there when you described that. What a powerful moment. Thank you for sharing that. And I guess this kind of segues into the next question that we wanted to ask you. And in that sense of, you know, why journalism matters, we ask all of our guests why journalism matters. And what would be your response to that?
It matters for the same reason Marie Colvin said to me, you know, way back. And I remember sitting beside her as the Israelis were literally running up the stairs. She said, I can't leave here because we need to see this. And we need to see this for the people that can't see it. And that for me, you know, wherever you find yourself as a journalist, wondering why you exist, you know, it's not to be on the evening news with your 90-second package. It's to find a story that wouldn't be told without you. Now, more and more, obviously, people are telling their own stories on social media. But even now, journalism is so vital so that we know which story to listen to. Because if everyone can tell a story, the act of journalism is finding the one that makes a difference, that defines this day in history. And more, you know, if journalists can get off their high horses and start really living the lives of the people that they're serving, I think there is actually a golden age ahead of us. I don't like the phrase storytelling because it sounds, and surveys show us actually that people hear the word storyteller and they don't believe it. So I don't talk about journalism as storytelling, but I do feel the eyewitness sense. We are the eyes of the wider public. So every day you can go out there and find some story that's worth telling, and elevate that testimony is a good day for a journalist. And every day you're, you know, pretending that you've got some sort of elite status as a priestly class of information carriers is a day you're failing. That's kind of my sense of it today.
To finding the one that makes a difference. And I remember memorably, you know, you used to say separating the noise from the news. And I suspect there's a kind of similarity there. And there's so many things which you've shared with us, which are super helpful, I think, for people in terms of mental health and journalism. But I'm just going to finish by asking, what would your advice be to our listeners? Or what one piece of mental health advice could you share that's helped you manage your mental health?
Well, I read a great book called The Power of Habit by Charles Duhigg. And one of the points he made was that when people who are addicts on whatever kind are trying to go cold turkey, it never works unless they find some small thing in their life that they can take control of. So if you're addicted to some form of drugs, well, then give up cigarettes, you know, give up something to allow you to prove to yourself that you can conquer some problem you're having. And I think, as I said, the early days, like for me, journalism in the war zone was an addiction. And I think what I realized is that there's tiny habits that you can develop that will give you another 5% of resilience. And then one more habit on top is 10%. And another habit. And before you know it, you suddenly have that 5 seconds before you lose your shit and you're faced by some trauma, because you've got the ability to take a breath. Take 4 breaths in and 6 out. And then you can start to master that moment when you are going to lose your mind, but you've just developed the habits that will allow you to have a pause in which you can catch it again. And that's, for me, over the years has been the secret of resilience versus survival. So, you know, sleep, exercise, food, being able to take a break from social media at that moment when you feel the emotion rising in your stomach, the ability to pause before you press the retweet button, the ability to hug your kids, just all of those small little things are about building up the incremental ability to master stress and anxiety. And the final thing is, it's not some illness to be overcome, like getting over the flu. I think anxiety in general is a chronic illness that will affect anybody that puts themselves on some edge, that puts themselves onto some frontier or tries to see around a corner. Anxiety is part of your life. It's going to be a chronic illness, if you want to put it that way, but also something that you can develop over time, increasing strength by making your peace with it. And that would be my final piece of advice. So just get the breath, master that ability to have 5 seconds before you do something stupid or say something stupid. And then over time, if you are going to live on the edge, whether it be on social media or as a media entrepreneur or as a news executive, then realize that anxiety is part of that life and that's okay.
Mark Little, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. What a pleasure to talk to you both.
So relieved I got to the end of this podcast just about with my voice intact. Apologies for my croaky voice today. It was fascinating to hear someone speaking so lyrically and articulately about his rich and varied career.
Yeah, and from that extraordinarily diverse career, it's so interesting to hear how Mark is still constantly learning and open to failure as something he can gain from. And I really liked his advice about making small changes to our habits. It's something I'm going to try and take away with me. It feels like a good way to fend off whenever I'm feeling potentially overwhelmed. Thank you for listening to this episode of Behind the Headlines. Please do share it and leave your reviews. And we look forward to you joining us next time.